This is XTP Media.
Hi, I'm Anthony Lindberg, Creative Director at Basic 6, and this episode is brought to you with the support of Basic 6. Basic 6 t-shirts are organic and ethically made. If you want a great t-shirt that shows that you know enough about aviation and aerospace by the designs they display, then get over to basic6.co.uk. Shipped anywhere in the world, you will get a 10% discount by using the promo code EXTENDED. You can only get this discount through this promotion, so wear the Aerospace to be seen in t-shirt. Go to basic6.co.uk. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Extended. My name's Gareth Stringer, I'm the editor of Global Aviation Resource, and would you believe this is episode 27, and for the third time, I believe, we are concentrating on a subject that we know is close to many of your hearts, and that is space. And we really do cover the sort of rocket history from way back, starting in the sort of 40s and 50s, right up to the future space planes in this episode. Fortunately, I'm not doing it on my own. As ever, Peter Johnson from XTP Media is here. Peter, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Gareth. Very excited about this episode. Got lots to get through, lots of great things coming out the UK and European space sector, so very excited.
I think by public demand would be a fair
bit of listener pressure.
Yeah, so popular have the previous two space episodes been. Of course, Tim Robinson, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace, is here as well. Tim, how are you?
I'm good, actually. Hello, everybody.
Now, before we go outside of the Earth's atmosphere, Tim, you've just ticked a new type off on your list of things what I have flown in.
Yeah, I mean, it did go above the atmosphere, but recently I was one of the first passengers to fly on Airbus's new composite aeroplane, the Airbus A350.
Wow.
That was down at their annual media briefing for aviation journalists and the world's media.
That's a jolly to the rest of you.
So and they put 150 of us on there, and we got to experience it for ourselves. So a nice hour's flight over the Pyrenees. Got it intercepted while we're on the way and escorted by a French Air Force Rafale fighter, and checked out this new airliner. So quick impressions. It's very spacious inside, very, very quiet. You know, being in an A321 on the flight home was like being in a Saturn V, and felt really, really good. You know, there's a lower cabin altitude like the 787, so you get off, you don't feel like you've been sort of flying, your eyes aren't itching. You know, that was only a short flight, but I'm sure for a longer flight, it'll really make a difference. So great airplane and a real sort of demonstration of the maturity of the flight test program and how confident Airbus are that they will put sort of 150 hacks on board and, fingers crossed. They were happy that you know, no one would break anything or pull out any wires or drop anything, you know, and they'd show off their new test aircraft. So entry into service is on track. First customer is Qatar Airways later this year. It's all looking good.
Excellent. I'm sure we've got Farnborough approaching, and I'm sure in a future episode when we talk about Farnborough that I'd be very, very surprised if A350 doesn't get some kind of mention there. But look, back to space, because that's what this episode is all about. So the news, that's also going to be space related, and we've kind of got a whole bundle of stories, Peter, that you've kind of pulled together here. But they're all kind of very much around the same space tourism, spaceport, all kind of the same subject, really.
Yeah, Gareth, this is really all based around the report recently published called the Space and Innovation Growth Strategy, which was a paper written to highlight the opportunity, I think, for the UK space sector, and titled, the BBC item is titled Needs National Space Programme is what it's all about. And at the moment, the industry in the UK, the aerospace industry, is worth about £9 to £10 billion per annum. And the plan is to move that up in the next couple of decades to £40 billion per annum, and moving space exports from the UK from the current £2 billion up to £25 billion per annum by 2030. So lots of numbers there, but what does this really mean? What it means is that for the first time ever, since the Americans really have been pushing all of these issues, do we see the UK stepping up to the mark. Not only are we a part of ESA, of course, but putting this into context, our space programme will be bigger than the current NASA budget. So that is the size of the space programme that we're potentially talking about in the UK, which makes it very, very exciting. And to be fair to the government and the Minister, David Willetts, they're really, really positive about this. They're investing in Skylon. They're putting £60 million behind that and the reaction engine power unit to that. You mentioned there that the government is backing a launch plan for space tourism. And that's out of this paper and out of the Growth Strategy Action Plan. We're looking for the UK potentially to have its own spaceport. I mean, this is really exciting times.
Tim, in your day job, you get lots of calls from PRs and you get press releases and you get invited to this, that and the other. We've got all this space news coming through now. I just wondered kind of two things. You know, one, we see some of these kinds of stories can unfortunately sometimes turn out to be sort of pie in the sky. You know, they get talked about, you never hear about them again. Does it feel different now? And are you seeing a lot more of these kinds of stories coming through, but they actually feel as if, crikey, you know, this actually is for real?
Yeah, I mean, there's a nice sort of head of steam that's built up. I mean, you know, having the UK sort of space agency, as it was, has been a real sort of boost. You know, and a lot of things have come together as well. You know, space agency, you've got Tim Peake. People are now kind of thinking about, oh, yes, you know, the fact that Virgin Galactic is, you know, Richard Branson, obviously UK, you've got that UK link there. So people now sort of started to think, moving beyond the traditional sort of UK thing was, well, we just want to do satellites and we'll just keep our little niche. There are some sort of challenges there. For example, you know, we can't, you know, in the UK, it's very difficult to build an airport, let alone a spaceport. So where are you going to put it? You know, who's going to be there with the placard and protest against it? There might be a couple of obvious sites, that people can pluck out, but you never know. These places that people sort of identified, yeah, might not actually be in the UK in a couple of years. So there's a bit of doubt there, and there's also, you know, pulling away into this sort of, like I say, you know, we've been quite happy to build it up quietly, get on with it, do this sort of like, you know, the satellite stuff, the science stuff, and let sort of France go away and do, you know, France, you know, go away and do the Ariane launches and all that kind of stuff. So we're really stepping up into the sort of a new league there. But again, it's a it's going to have its sort of challenges.
Yeah, and I mean, just to put the point that Tim made there about the world's satellite program and the UK share of it, we produce about 40% of the world's small satellites. And of course, you know, we've mentioned before Surrey Satellites Limited being a key player in that. But this is all about really having a cohesive space program and a space plan. And sitting behind that, the strategy to deliver it all. And we've seen things like the Space Business Hub that's being launched in Strathclyde at the university there by the Satellite Applications Catapult team. So all of a sudden, yeah, I think you're right, Gareth, we're starting to see things emerging that really tend to suggest that this is more than just, you know, a telephone book size report that that somebody's going to put on the shelf and nothing's going to be done about it. And as I say, fair cop to the government, they're really getting behind it.
It's also interesting to think it's not just about the hardware. We tend to think, oh, space, right? Okay, launchers, satellites, hardware. It's also about the services you can develop from it. You know, like Inmarsat. Inmarsat are amazingly profitable company because they've got all the services from their satellites. So it's kind of figuring out stuff like that as to, right, okay, would you want a refreshed, satellite imagery of Google Maps? You know, could you provide little satellites that go up and do certain tasks? Micro satellites, nano satellites, etc., and get services or get people to pay for it,
And we mentioned Skylon there and the reaction engines, and I think a year or two ago, and I certainly listened to them on Talking Space, actually, talking about the product when we all thought another fantastic British invention, but where will it go? You know, the government's putting £60 million behind that. And again, another report on Skylon has just been published to say that actually the economics are stacking up. And if they can get this right, it can be a really competitive product. And interestingly enough, I see they compare it to not only to Ariane and also the Russian launchers, but also to the American Falcon 9, which is about two-thirds of the current rate of cost for a rocket launch. They think they can be competitive with that. So, you know, potentially things do look good, but of course, you know, it's got to fall into place. Things have got to happen in the right order. Otherwise, this is all going to come literally tumbling down. But certainly the signs are very positive. And I think as an industry, it's a very exciting time. And I know we're going to hear a little bit about that later on in the programme.
Well, just finally, before we move on, you just hit the nail on the head piece as well, because I think we'd probably all agree that regardless of, you know, whether people are into the business and the numbers and all that or not, if you're interested in space, it is a really, really exciting time as well, just because all this stuff's going on. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as Apollo children, we grew up with that. And, you know, we'll hear a bit more about that a little later on some of the history of the space sector. But I think for the first time in my life, I'm really excited about a lot of these opportunities actually coming through. And, you know, talking to people in the industry and talking to some of the young graduates and some of the students coming into the industry, they're really excited about the future. And that's just got to be good, not only for the British and European space programs, but of course, for, you know, for human spaceflight in its totality. Because I think the reality is, you know, when we could talk about getting to places like Mars, but these are going to be missions that will need, you know, many of the space agencies working together to deliver. And I think for the first time, our voice is being heard. And as Tim said there, we've got Tim Peake next year going up to the ISS. And he's certainly got a high profile. And, you know, we'll be able to start matching the Germans and the French, because they not only are members of ESA, but they've also got individual space programs that are very big and very strong. And we just don't have that right now. But I think the future's looking good.
Well said.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Roger, I understand SM Jet 13812. It's not that time critical, Jim.
Can we do it at any time, Joe?
I think so, but let me check. Yes, Houston, that's affirmative. You can jettison the service module when you're ready. No big rush, but anytime.
Okay, sounds good.
Apollo Control, Houston, 138 hours, 1 minute into the flight. As you heard earlier, Joe Kerwin told Apollo 13 that they could separate at their convenience. That followed the time identified by Jim Lovell, which would be some 2 minutes after what we had earlier counted.
Right, we're talking space, and another person that does that cunning segue coming up is G. McCulker, who is from Talking Space. He's a friend of Extended, if you like, a previous guest. We know you like to hear from him. And Peter caught up with him to have a chat about the future of space exploration, particularly from the USA standpoint.
Gene, welcome to Extended.
Hey, Peter, how's it going? I'm glad to be here.
Yes, great to have you back on the show. Really, really excited to get the update from around the world and particularly from NASA. But before we start, just wanted to add our congratulations to episode 200 of the Talking Space program. And yet again, guys outshone. It was a great episode.
Yeah, we kind of really got lucky with the gentleman that we interviewed on that one. And I'm kind of, you would have told me we would have gone 200 episodes, I would have I would have been like, yeah, you're right, you're kidding. Yeah. But here we are. Just to let folks know, we just Sawyer and myself, we just finished a recording, episode 201, which will be a special 2-hour episode.
Wow.
on activities surrounding SpaceFest 6. And we also have an interview with somebody over in Canada that's trying to shake up the space tourism industry up there. So that's waiting in the wings.
Okay, interesting stuff. Look forward to that. But as we normally do, Gene, let's go around the world and have a little chat about what's been going on recently. And of course, the big issue that we all face is twofold. One, the budget situation and NASA's budget situation. And secondly, the deteriorating relationships between Russia and the USA. Let's take the budget first. I thought that NASA had secured a good, strong budget, but not all is well at the moment, is it?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Real fast, there is some budgetary issue going on. NASA did clear about maybe, I think the number is about an extra $245 or $250 million in this past budget, but I believe overall the budget was about $17.9 billion.
Right.
Dollars. That is still, it makes sure that the Space Launch System and Orion are healthy, but it still does not really, really robustly fund the commercial crew program. That is one of my main worries, because right now I think that should be kind of front and center. Like it or not, there's a big hullabaloo in the Senate right now, along with the House. One side of the aisle is trying to basically cut the knees out from underneath the program, where the other side of the aisle is trying to make sure it's healthy. My thoughts on this are, right now, like it or not, this is the wall that we've sort of painted ourselves into, so to speak. Yeah. But like it or not, commercial crew is the fastest way that we're going to be able to go ahead and get crew from the United States and from ESA and other nations off of Earth from U.S. soil on a U.S. spacecraft, period. So, in fact, one movement in the budget sort of tries to go ahead and tell NASA basically to select only one provider. I think the game plan now is to select two. My thought is, give them all a shot and let's see who can operate it more efficiently.
That's
just not going on that way. The other thing too is planetary science did okay in the budget, but there's still room for improvement there. The Sophia telescope, which is an airborne facility that sits on a 747, I believe it's based out of the Ames Research Center in California. It is a joint presentation between NASA and the German space agency DLR. That is right now on life support, which to me is a darn shame.
Yeah, I thought that had been saved. It sort of looked like it was on its way out, and then I thought the budget had saved it, but obviously not.
Nope, and in fact, there is I believe I was reading just this morning, as a matter of fact, there's some movement in the Senate to go ahead and try to save that, or just basically disagreeing with NASA, the way NASA's allocated funds, and saying that has to be allocated. But I don't know. We're gonna, put on your safety belts type situation, and we'll just have to see how all that plays out.
And talking about getting to the getting off of planet Earth, but particularly to the ISS, we've all read the press about the potential longevity of the ISS. But getting there at the moment is by Soyuz and Soyuz only.
Right.
But the Russians, they're really having a torrid time with another Proton failure, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Proton M failed again. I believe the third stage failed to ignite or something along those lines. There's going to be a report released, I think, this week as we record here. Yeah. So I believe Roscosmos is going to release a report sometime this week about what the final findings were on that. But there is a new booster in the works. It is going to be launched from the new Russian facility out in Plyask. They will have two launch facilities, one in Plyask now and one in Baikonur. And the idea, too, is Plyask is within the Russian territory, whereas Baikonur is in Kazakhstan. So you want to make sure that, the Russians are trying to make sure that they have the ability to launch, just like here in the United States, that they're able to launch from Russian soil. So it kind of makes sense.
And that does look quite an impressive facility they're creating at Plyask, isn't it?
Yeah, I've only seen photographs of the facility, but it's quite a an impressive place. I'm not too sure. I don't know what its entire capability is going to be long term, but and how it stacks up against places like KSC and so on. Yeah. But that will be their premier launch site going forward.
Right, okay. And you recently, digressing a little bit, saw a presentation at SpaceFest 6 by Anatoly Zak?
That's correct. Anatoly Zak is a wonderful journalist and Russian spaceflight historian, and he gave a rather interesting presentation about what's coming up with the Russian program. There is a look, sort of looking inward at Russia right now. They're trying to go ahead and look at ways to do things by themselves. They're not really looking to do a lot of partnerships anymore. However, if you look at the news, it's kind of contrary. So you really don't know what the devil the Russians are thinking about right now. I mean, because even this past week, there was a conference that U.S. and Russian folks attended side by side, you know, political situation notwithstanding. If you looked at the launch, for instance, of Expedition 4041 just recently, I mean, they were all like, you know, yeah, shaking hands and hugging each other and all this. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of one, you kind of wonder, you know, what's going on. It seems like the politicos in some ways live in a different world than the rest of us do.
Yeah. And of course, one of the biggest challenges that the US has at the moment is the fact that the Atlas V is driven and motored by the RD-180, the Russian RD-180, and that's causing all sorts of issues at the moment because the Russians are going to stop supply, aren't they?
Well, that's what we're hearing. If the Russians shut down the stop import or stop exporting the RD-180 here to the United States, it essentially shuts down Atlas V, which means that not only is the U.S. military in trouble because they use Atlas V predominantly for their launches, but also some planetary missions may be in trouble, and also some other the commercial crew program may be in trouble, because I believe Boeing is going to use their CST-100 capsule is going to be launched on Atlas V, and ditto the Dream Chaser, which is Sierra Nevada's entry. So there was a move, I believe, I was just reading this article just yesterday, where Aerojet Rocketdyne, who's an American company here that supplies engines, you know, again, they import, believe it or not, they import the NK-33 engine, which comes from Russia, and you know, play with it, hop it up, and turn it into what's called the AJ-26. And that, by the way, operates the Antares booster from Orbital. But there was a move, I believe, an announcement yesterday or just a couple of days ago about a new engine that is under development called the AR-1, and that Aerojet Rocketdyne is looking to to replace the RD-180. So there is an RD-180 replacement in the works. They're saying that could come online as early as 2 years from now. So, you know, you've got there are ways. I mean, if the Russians go ahead and say, okay, no more RD-180 exports, yeah, there's going to be some pain for a while here in the United States, but it's going to be pain that we're going to be able to recover from, you know, within possibly, you know, 2 to 4 years.
Yeah. I got to say, Jane, I didn't know the Atlas V was powered by a Russian engine. I mean, I don't know whether it escaped me, but obviously it escaped a lot of other people who weren't doing their homework, and it always seemed like a bit of an embarrassment.
Well, not so much. I think it was really, really complacency, you know, on our part, whereby, well, you know, we've got this thing that's off the shelf. Why do we go ahead and spend $1.9 billion, essentially, to develop our own engine when we can just pull this thing off the shelf and plug it in? So, but now, you know, the guys that kind of, you know, are calling the shots right now are saying, eh, maybe we're not going to send this to you anymore because there's a whole, as you pointed out, there's a lot of political stuff. There's some political stuff going on as a result of the Crimea situation and Ukraine and all that. So there's going to be some sort of fallout. But, you know, there are ways of working around it. And I'm not saying there's going to be pain, but it's, I think, and I'm speaking now as a U.S. citizen, but I think right now it's in our best interests to have a domestic engine to plug into a vehicle that essentially launches a lot of military satellites that could be called up upon for national security purposes. It's ridiculous.
It does feel very unusual, but let's move on then. Let's talk about commercial crew and where we're at. I always get very confused about where we're going with the commercial crew program, but let's start off with SpaceX, shall we?
Sure.
The Dragon 2, that's just been unveiled, and we've got a small insert from that unveiling.
Welcome, everybody, to Hawthorne, headquarters of Space Exploration Technologies. We're here to unveil Dragon version 2. Dragon version 1 is right above your heads. In fact, this is the first Dragon spacecraft that came back from orbit. And you can see the scorch marks on the heat shield, the thrusters that are fired. It's a real spacecraft. I'll start off by telling you a little bit about the Dragon version 1 before showing you Dragon version 2. When we first created Dragon version 1, we didn't really know how to create a spacecraft. We'd never designed a spacecraft before. So while there are a lot of interesting technologies in version 1, it does have a relatively conventional landing approach. So it throws out parachutes to land in the water off the coast of California after it comes back from the space station. And it does have a life support system, but not one that can last for a long time or carry a lot of people. And so it's a great spacecraft, and it was a great proof of concept. It showed us what it took to bring something back from orbit, which is a very difficult thing to do. Usually when something comes in from orbital velocity, it burns up in a big fireball. So, but going from Dragon version 1, we wanted to take a big step in technology, really create something that was a step change in spacecraft technology. And some important characteristics of that are the ability to land anywhere on land propulsively. So that's one of the things that Dragon version 2 will be able to do. So you'll be able to land anywhere on Earth with the accuracy of a helicopter, which is I think something that a modern spaceship should be able to do. And it'll be capable of carrying seven astronauts for several days. It has an improved version of our Pika heat shield, and it's all around I think a really big leap forward in technology. It really takes things to the next level. So with that, let's see the Dragon version 1. We're going to do the countdown here. All right. Oh, Dragon version 2.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
0. That is how a 21st century spaceship should land. a few other things. So I'm going to talk about some of the hardware in Dragon, some of the technologies. We're going to roll those out. And so a few things I should mention that you saw in the animation, but we don't have time to show you today, are there's the docking mechanism. So the Dragon version 2 is capable of autonomously docking, either autonomously or under pilot docking with the space station, or you know, with the International Space Station, potentially other things, and without needing a station arm. So the current version 1 makes use of the Canadarm that's on the space station. Dragon version 2 is capable of docking autonomously without the use of the arm. So that's a significant upgrade as well, and although it wasn't shown in the video, Dragon version 2 still retains the parachutes of Dragon version 1, so that what it'll do is when it reaches a particular altitude, just before landing, a few miles before landing, It will test the engines, verify that if all the engines are working, it will then proceed to a propulsive landing. If there's any anomaly detected with the engines or the propulsion system, it will then deploy the parachutes to ensure a safe landing, even in the event that the propulsion system is not working. And even after starting the propulsion system, it can afford to lose up to two engines and still land safely. And then after the engines are started, it deploys the landing legs for a soft landing. And so the reason that this is really important, apart from the convenience of the landing location, is that it enables rapid reusability of the spacecraft. So you can just reload propellant and fly again. This is extremely important for revolutionizing access to space, because as long as we continue to throw away rockets and spacecraft, we will never have truly true access to space. It'll always be incredibly expensive. You can imagine a scenario where in aircraft, if aircraft were thrown away with each flight, that nobody would be able to fly, or very few, maybe a small number of government customers, and the same is true of rockets and spacecraft. So that's really why it's so important to be able to land propulsively, land on land, and be able to then reload propellant and take off again. So I'll look at point out some of the technologies here. This is a composite overwrapped titanium sphere, and this contains the ultra high pressure helium that pressurizes the propulsion tanks that feed the Super Draco engine. This is the Draco engine, which is a maneuvering thruster, and this is essentially the same as the one that's, or very similar to the one that's on Dragon version 1. And on Dragon version 1, there are 18 of these thrusters for maneuvering in space, as well as controlling the reentry, the trajectory during reentry. So we have a bunch of these on version 2 as well. From a propulsion standpoint, the biggest single change for Dragon version 2 is the addition of the Super Draco engines. So this is really a super-powered version of the Draco engine, whereas the Draco engine produces about 100 pounds of thrust. Each of these engines produce 16,000 pounds of thrust. So hence the super. and they're in pairs, so that if one malfunctions, its pair can take over and increase thrust to compensate for the one that's not firing. And each one is in a protective shell, so if anything goes wrong, it's contained within that protective nacelle. This is also will be the first fully printed engine. So this is it's printed Inconelis, which is a special high-strength alloy. And it'll be, like I said, the first time that a printed rocket engine sees flight. And then this is the propellant tank. This a whole series of these spheres are around the perimeter of Dragon V2, and these are also carbon overwrapped titanium, and they feed the Super Draco engines, which are operating. The Super Draco engines are operating at a chamber pressure of about 1,000 psi, and fed from these series of propellant tanks around the perimeter. And then we also have version 3 of the Pika heat shield. So the base heat shield is the third version of our heat shield technology. The first version obviously flew on that version 1 spacecraft up there, and we're now about to fly sort of version 2 and version 3. And with each one, we're able to make the reusability of the heat shield better. So it ablates less as it enters, and so we're able to get more flights. So that's Dragon version 2. Although it'd be nice to go inside. So I'm sitting here in the pilot seat. And pull that down. So we've aimed for something with the Dragon version 2 for the interfaces and for the overall aesthetic of something that's very clean, very simple. So as the pilot, you were able to interact with the screens overhead.
control the spacecraft, and then we've got all of the critical functions that are needed in an emergency situation as manual buttons. So that's what you see in this area here. All right, that's all a lot easier in zero-G, by the way. So there you have it, Dragon version 2, capable of carrying up to 7 astronauts, propulsively landing almost anywhere in the world, and something that's designed, as I said, to be fully reusable. So you can fly this multiple times, allowing for potential dramatic reduction in the cost of access to space. Thank you.
Apart from the drama and the presentation of it all, it looked slightly frail to me. I mean, the touchscreen technology and that sort of thing has got to be the way forward, but it just didn't feel like a robust product.
Well, I'm sure the interior of that vehicle is going to look very, very different from what you saw at the presentation. That's one. Yeah. Okay. If you go ahead and take a look, there's no life support systems in there or anything like that. That was essentially a boilerplate version of what the real vehicle is going to look like.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the way I took it. As far as the touch screens are concerned, yeah, that's a little bit of an interesting way of dealing with it, but I'm sure that they've got ergonomic experts over there that understand that how a gloved hand essentially is going to manipulate these touch screens, or else they would not be able to really, really go any further. I will say that Garrett Reisman, who is essentially in charge of safety and continuity of the Dragon version 2, is a former shuttle astronaut. And he knows darn well that his former compatriots are going to be flying on this thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So from a safety standpoint, I think he's going to be looking at this and giving a lot of scrutiny to what actually goes inside the vehicle. So what you saw at that presentation, which to me had all of the frills of an Apple product presentation of old, if you remember what Steve Jobs used to do. I mean, heck, the way that was going, I thought Musk was going to come on wearing a mock turtleneck and jeans. he might as well have.
Yeah, it was quite dramatic.
Yeah, but it was basically for the press. It was basically for the fans out there that are really, really ardent supporters of SpaceX, but ultimately, the idea is to try to go ahead and make this vehicle as safe as possible. And I think if you've got somebody, again, the caliber of Garrett Reisman, who is a former shuttle astronaut, he's going to make darn sure that his fellows are darn safe inside that spacecraft. So I think what you saw at that presentation is going to be tremendously different from what is actually going to be flight hardware.
And where are the others? Where are Boeing and Sierra Nevada then in terms of their status? It sort of feels like SpaceX is in every news space news story at the moment. Where are the others?
Well, Sierra Nevada just completed their wind tunnel tests just last month, I believe, out at and somebody's going to check me out there. I want to say Langley in Virginia, but I may be wrong. But they just completed their wind tunnel test. They're right on time with their schedule currently. I believe Boeing is going to go ahead and introduce their interior alongside the folks from Bigelow Aerospace. They're going to be introducing their interior alongside the folks over at Bigelow Aerospace, I believe this month, in Las Vegas. So that will be interesting to see how that's going to go. I've seen some some of the interior shots, you know, the CGI shots, and I thought it was rather ingenious. What they're doing is they're using a lot of blue light inside the spacecraft, some kind of really, really subdued blue light, which makes the spacecraft kind of look bigger than it actually is from the inside. It's sort of this optical illusion. Yeah. So you've got, so that's going to be kind of interesting to see what they're doing, but they're also moving along quite nicely.
So tell me, Gene, and again, maybe it's just me, but I get a bit confused. Where's Orion sit in all of this? What's the difference between Orion and these guys?
Okay, the three commercial crew folks, they are essentially contracted out by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to provide launch services to the International Space Station. Essentially, these folks are going to be our taxis, basically, to the ISS.
Yeah.
They will be carrying not only astronauts from NASA, but ESA as well, and most likely Russian astronauts. To and from the International Space Station. The neat thing about this, it is both all of these vehicles will carry seven astronauts to low Earth orbit. Where Orion fits into this is entirely different. Orion is essentially an interplanetary spacecraft. It's sort of like the Apollo on steroids type thing. Oh, and to use Orion to, you know, to go, you could go ahead and use Orion to dock with ISS. I believe it will carry about four astronauts, but the way I believe it was described to me, it would be sort of like using a sledgehammer to take out a fly. That's kind of the best way I can do it. Orion is a little bit more robust in its technology, and it's really, really designed to go into planetary. Orion is sort of a holdover, if you will, from the old Constellation program, and it is the spacecraft that essentially got pulled in from that. Orion 2 has had a bit of a sordid history as well. It started out as part of Constellation. It was canceled outright by the Obama administration in 2010. Then it was reincarnated by the Obama administration, but not as an interplanetary spacecraft. It was supposed to be a cargo up, crew down vehicle, which to me was ridiculous.
Okay. All right, yeah.
And then the finally somebody came to their senses and brought Orion back to the interplanetary spacecraft that it was going to be.
And Orion, I suppose the difference that I see from Orion is a NASA-driven development, whereas the others are, in effect, commercial operations.
Yeah, that too kind of is a little fuzzy, because NASA has a big investment in all three of these guys.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
To say this is totally and completely commercial, the U.S. taxpayer is still has a significant investment in all three spacecraft that are under development. Don't get me wrong, they are also putting their own funds into this program as well, but NASA's also throwing money at this program.
Well, we've covered a fair bit there, Gene, already. Just a few other things throw on the table. One thing I didn't ask you about, but I wanted to ask you about, is... is it X-37?
Oh, the X-37B.
Yeah.
Now, yes.
It's been up there forever.
Yes.
It's, of course, the US Air Force's mini shuttle, I think it's been described as. It looks like a small shuttle. Quietly going about doing its business, which, of course, none of us know. But in the meantime, is setting record after record for space endurance.
Yeah, they nobody knows what the devil this thing's doing. It does have a small little cargo bay in there. But in its appearance, folks can go ahead and Google it. In its appearance, it does have a very reminiscent look of our old orbiters, which are sitting in museums right now.
Yeah.
There is, believe it or not, I think Boeing did at one point have a piloted version of it, if anybody was interested. But it, I don't think it really, really went anywhere. It's still on the drawing board. It's still available if anybody wants to go ahead and try to pull it out of mothballs. But it was really, really never fabricated as far as going forward. Yeah. But yeah, nobody really knows what that's up to, and we're not going to really know until the Air Force isn't going to tell us that they're going to be bringing it down anytime soon. So
yeah.
I have really, you know, this is sort of a black project. I have no idea really what's going on with it currently, and I don't really know anybody that can, at least in a public sense, give me an idea as far as what the Air Force's long-range plan with this is. Yeah. I do know that it will be serviced out of the Kennedy Space Center. I believe one of the old orbiter processing facilities was brought online, and Boeing is now using that for processing of the X-37B, or soon will be using it for processing on the X-37B. So this former OPF is going to be part of this little black project there. So it's going to be, and the interesting thing is that orbiter processing facility really is a stone's throw away from the vehicle assembly building. So I'm kind of wondering how they're going to go ahead from a security standpoint and deal with that.
It's going to be
interesting to watch going forward with that.
Yeah, and two other very quick novel projects on the table and we're seeing a lot of at the moment is NASA's parachute system, which is being tested in Hawaii, and of course SpaceX's Grasshopper design and the commercial capabilities of that coming back for reuse. Both novel and innovative ideas, and both seem to be working well.
Well, we'll find out soon enough when that infamous little flying saucer, if you will, that NASA has designed to test the parachute. I believe that's been pushed back to this week, but due to weather.
Right.
That whole chute system is going to be tested to try to figure out what the devil we're going to need to do to get to Mars and how we're going to slow our vehicles down. Because you have to remember, if we're going to use it for a piloted spacecraft, we're talking something about the size of a three-story house. Yeah. And we've never landed anything that big. So
right, okay.
We've got to learn how to essentially slow something like that down, and that's essentially what this parachute system hopefully is going to be designed to do, is to slow down a much larger spacecraft as it descends through the Martian atmosphere and ultimately to a landing. So that's where this comes into play.
As
far as the SpaceX Grasshopper is concerned, I believe the final prototype on that flew not too long ago. They did do a test on the last vehicle that launched, and it did pretty darn good, according to what SpaceX has told us. There was a video of the landing, if you will, on where it's made a quote soft landing, close quote, into the Atlantic after the last launch, and the video was cleaned up a little bit, and it does show a little bit of something there, but according to what SpaceX is saying, a lot of their telemetry says that everything looked fantastic and looked the way they wanted it to look. So we'll see what happens, because a lot of that sort of, soft landing technology NASA wants to look at from the standpoint of going to Mars and landing a large vehicle on Mars. So there's going to be some collaboration, I think, going on over there.
Right. Well, there's an awful lot in all of that that we've talked about. But was there anything, Gene, you wanted to add from Space Fest?
Yeah, just real quick. You folks over in Britain blow me away.
Thank you. They,
I mean that. You folks over in the UK, I mean, there is a good core group over there that is doing some fantastic space outreach. I was hanging around with a great British contingent from while I was over in Pasadena, and first off, I have to give a shout out to everybody
yep.
over there.
Yeah, go on then.
yeah, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. Mr. John Richards, who, by the way, kind of put together a wonderful trip over to Mount Wilson, the Mount Wilson Observatory, for a whole group of us, and essentially put the icing on the cake for the entire event. John, you rock. You're the man. Another gentleman, Richard Scott, Sam Mundell, short for Samantha. She's also just a very, very ardent, you know, supporter of the human space program. Amjad Zadi, Amjad, I'm sorry if I blew your last name. I do apologize, but you know, again, he's also the quintessential gentleman, and also very, very ardent and very, very passionate about spaceflight. And again, Rick Howes, I mean Rick, Nick Howes. I'm sorry, Nick, you're going to shoot me. he should be a familiar face to some of your listeners anyway, a great astronomer in his own right, and also the quintessential gentleman. In fact, he emceed a few of the sessions on Sunday, again, a huge shout out to him. There just seems to be a really big British contingent out there that is very, very supportive of human spaceflight, really wants to see it go on, and is really, really trying to do some good outreach over there.
Yeah, well, we've got some great challenges ahead of us, particularly in the UK, but Europe as well. But in the UK, the aerospace sector is set to grow very significantly in the next decade. So it's a very exciting time, particularly for young engineers and young astronomers to get involved in the sector, because it's only going to grow, and there's some wonderful projects, and hopefully we'll be able to bring a few on this show. Of course, we've talked about, and you've talked about, Skylon and the reactive engines, everything from that through to space planes. So it's a very exciting time.
Indeed, I think Airbus just tested a space plane just recently. Yep. We have a spaceport being proposed in the UK. Yep. Tim Peake is going to be flying on the International Space Station soon. There's talk of expanding the UK's participation in experimentation on board the ISS. So there's a lot going on over there. There's a lot of exciting things going on in the UK right now. And hats off to you guys. It's going to be kind of fun to watch. And again, Skylon is a huge project, and I'm wishing everybody involved with that, including, you know, the folks over at Reaction Engines that are designing the Sabre engine, that could just, you know, really, if it all works, can seriously revolutionize not only spaceflight, but also aviation. And yeah. And that is going to be spectacular to watch. So my fingers are crossed, and I'm wishing all of that all the best.
Well, Gene, it's been fantastic having you back on the program again. An insight we couldn't get anywhere else. Where can we find out about you online?
Thanks, Peter. You can either visit www.talkingspaceonline.com or visit us on iTunes. Just do a search for Talking Space.
Well, I'm very excited for your next special episode, and do come back on the program on our next episode focused on space, Gene, because you bring something that we just don't have.
Peter, it's always an honor and a privilege to appear here in front of your microphones and in front of your audience, and I appreciate the invitation to come back, and I'm so thrilled to be here, honestly.
Thanks very much, Gene.
Thank you.
Pete, some fascinating stuff there, some real sort of positives, but some negatives as well. Lots and lots to talk about. Is there, you know, where do you want to start?
I think the first thing, it's sad to see Sophia potentially at risk here and being dropped due to cost. As I said to Gene, I thought it had been saved, but it doesn't look like it. So that's going to be sad. But I think the thing that really grabs me is, did either of you know about the Russian-powered RD-180s, you know, powering the Atlas V rockets that were sending US military hardware up into the sky? It powers Dream Chaser. I didn't know that.
No, I didn't have a clue.
I have to say, so that was on my radar.
We knew we had seen the team for some reason, Tim.
It's an example of the, you know, interdependence and how close the partnership is between sort of the post Cold War Russian and U.S. space programs.
Yeah.
You know, who would have thought it back in, you know, sort of they've been so close partners, so tightly linked. You know, people are going up on Soyuzes and stuff, and all of a sudden someone turns around and says, "Oh no, actually, those rocket engines you rely on can't have them anymore."
Yeah. And the Elon Musk unveiling of Dragon, of course, was interesting. And he talked about the spacecraft landing. And of course, it's expected to return to back to terra firma, landing itself upright. So we'll put a link to the SpaceX video of that.
And you know, like you said so before about having someone like Elon Musk, having someone like Tim Peake, it's so inspiring for young people, because actually, you know, your path now is not, oh, I know what I'll do. You know, if I want to get into space, it's not, for a UK youngster, it's not, oh, well, I'm going to have to go to the US, renounce my citizenship, you know, take US citizenship, join the military, become a test pilot, you know, yada, 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 and maybe I might get on a shuttle mission. Now that there's lots of different ways, you know, you could join Virgin Galactic, you could go and work for Elon Musk, you could go and do this, you could go and do that. So it's a lot more.
A lot of opportunities, aren't there?
Yeah. There's a lot more different ways now, and that's inspiring. Yeah.
But did you notice there that Elon Musk, and I don't know whether it was intentional, when he was inside the Dragon capsule, the Dragon 2 capsule, he called them pilot seats. He didn't call them astronaut seats. I wonder if that's was just a slip of the tongue, or whether that was intentional.
I wonder.
Well, it's a reusable spacecraft, isn't it? And the technology he's brought, and as Gene said there, you know, it is pretty much a template unit at the moment, and probably will change a fair bit.
The inside does look cooler.
It does. Yeah. It does look awesome. And talking about cool things, I did ask Gene there about the X-37B as well. That's intriguing, isn't it? No one knows what it's doing up there. The Air Force, the US Air Force, are not going to tell anyone, but it's setting records. It's been up for 400 plus days, I think, now. Wonder what it's up to. And just before we leave G's segment there, he mentioned Amjad Zardy, and I've been in touch with Amjad. Lovely guy, very supportive of the aerospace sector. And he writes for a magazine called Rocket STEM, which is not the most glamorous title for a magazine, but I can assure you it's a really good read, and its aim is to inspire the next generation of students and educators. I'm not in either of those categories, but if you like technology, you like a bit about astronomy, and the two of them together, it really is a great read. It's free, it's a PDF download, so I recommend that to you. We'll put links in the show notes to that, but if you go to rocketstem.org, you can download that there.
And let's just say as well, huge thanks to Gene. He's been very, very kind to extend it with the time that he's given. That's another excellent, excellent segment. Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Gene.
Yeah, thanks.
Game challenge begins. Launch. Circular orbit. Rapid rendezvous. Intercept and dock with International Space Station.
All engine running. Lift off. Tower clear.
Push the ISS to higher orbit. Rescue EVA astronauts. Avoid space debris. Destroy debris with missiles. Protect the ISS for as long as possible. Deorbit. Land. Survive.
All in a day's work.
We had a pretty large bank. Hey, we had a problem here.
Post control, both autos. He's in engine command override off.
We've had shutdown.
Leo. Low Earth Orbit. A game from SkyrocketCafe.com.
First stage propellant tanks have been pressurized. Now past the 1 minute mark, and we are going on internal power. Now all systems to internal power. We'll be looking for the engine start sequence at the 8.9 second mark in the countdown. The engines will build up to a thrust of 7.6 million pounds. T-minus 30 seconds. We have a cutoff. We have a cutoff at T-minus 30 seconds. We're standing by at T-minus 30 second mark. We'll bring word to you just as soon as we get it. We have a cutoff at T-minus 30 seconds.
Where to begin with this next segment? This is an interview Peter's conducted again with Mike Annis. Mike is the man behind the Space Rocket History podcast and very, very much a man after my own heart. He is, I was going to say, in the midst of putting together this incredible series of podcasts, but who knows how far it's actually going to go. Very much looking at the sort of birth of the space program, Mercury. He's currently looking at Gemini, which I know he says is the forgotten space program, and will no doubt crack onto Apollo as well. But before we listen, Peter, is there anything you'd just like to add? It's an absolutely incredible interview.
He's an absolute diamond of a guy, lovely guy to talk to, full of interesting facts. But his passion for the subject really comes through, and I genuinely feel I've never read anything like this anywhere, let alone heard it. So he certainly has something that I think is unique in both the history circles, but also in the technology circles as well. So here's Mike.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You've got speed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
They might be out. Okay, I'm out. Yeah, it looks funny out there. See my glove out there, Jim.
Jimmy Moore, get back in.
Okay.
Good morning, Gordo.
Yes, how are you?
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
By cooperating together in these new realms of infinity.
We have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Mike, welcome to Extended.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Well, it's an absolute goldmine, I feel like I've discovered, the Rocket History podcast. Mike, how did you come about creating this program? What's your background?
Well, to answer that question, let me start from the beginning.
Yeah.
I grew up in a great time for space exploration. I was born in early 1960s. And and I was particularly inspired by the Apollo missions, starting with Apollo 7. That's the first one I remember, and I began following all the Apollo missions after that.
Right, okay.
And I can remember the early Apollo missions. They had a lot of TV coverage of that. So about every time you turned on the TV and there was a mission going on, that was the only thing on all three networks.
Yeah.
So, of course, I, like most of my children, most children my age, watched it. And I can remember at that time, 1968, or I wanted to be an astronaut when I grew up.
Okay. Yeah.
And I can remember joining a little rocketry club. It was all about the Apollo missions that they had for a couple years while they were big. And I used to build those old plastic model kits of the spacecraft, like the Mercury and the Gemini and Apollo. And naturally, the Apollo was the most expensive, so I didn't get one of those. Yeah. I stuck with the Gemini model kit, and I put that together, and I played with that thing for years until I'd practically destroyed it, really. And I can remember back in 69 witnessing the launch of Apollo 12. The family took a trip down to Florida, and I got to witness the launch, and it was, well, it was a little less overwhelming because we were at a distance from it, but it was kind of foggy that day, and I remember my mother saying, "Was that all there was to it?" But you could see it go up there. I liked it. Yeah. And then in the 70s, I became interested in flying model rockets. These are the little rockets you build, and they have a solid fuel engine, and they fly up to maybe 1,000 feet or 300 meters, something like that.
Yeah.
And I probably built 100 of those and flew them every time I had enough money to buy an engine. So as I grew older, though, I started thinking seriously about my career, and I realized I probably would not become an astronaut. So I selected an auxiliary career. Since I was always a fan of technology and technical aspects of things, I went to the university and I chose the field of electrical engineering, and I remained in that field for about 20 years. Then I decided to do something different. I went back to school and earned a history degree, and then followed that up with a master's degree in the information science field. And I taught school for about 7 years, and right now, currently, I'm back doing consultant work for engineering.
Wow, okay. So your interest in space and rockets is purely as an enthusiast?
Yes, it's purely as an enthusiast. Wow. I wish I could go up in one, but maybe SpaceX or Virgin Atlantic.
Yeah.
We'll get something going soon, but I couldn't afford to go in that much.
I was going to say, we'll have to get some more donations for that to happen.
Yeah, we'll need some more for that.
Yeah, maybe we can crowdsource it or something like that. But Mike, okay, understand where you're coming from. I just want to go back a little bit to that rocket launch. Can you still hear the sound of that rocket?
It was fairly quiet from across the bay. It was... I remember we were on that little, on the other side of the little river next to the pad.
Yeah.
And it must have been maybe, it could be a mile away or something like that, maybe two.
Yeah.
And it was foggy that day, and everybody, the countdown was going on, and everybody's looking at it, and it looked, through the fog, it looked more like a little spark. Hmm. I didn't really hear that much, and it gone. It was gone fast. I'm telling you, that thing shot up there. And I guess that's why my mother's reaction was that all, because we went to Florida to see this thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've seen one launch. I saw a military launch from the Cape about 10, 12 years ago. And that was my recollection as well. I saw it across over at Titusville, and it just was up so quickly. I was really surprised. But the sound was something that stuck with me, that crackling sound. It you know, whenever I hear any audio now, it sort of brings it back. But anyway, enough reminiscing. Let's talk about the program. For those unfamiliar with the program, can you tell us just a little bit about it and what you cover?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The podcast is about the history of rocketry and space exploration. I began with a brief coverage of ancient rocketry, starting in 3000 BC with the first Babylonian astronomers. Then I moved ahead to 400 BC and covered Archytas' steam-propelled wooden pigeon. And then the rocket arrows that the Chinese used in 1232 AD. Then I moved to Galileo and Newton and his third law, the action-reaction principle of a rocket.
Yeah.
Then I moved into the pioneers of rocketry in the 20th century, Goddard, Tsiolkovsky, Oberth, the first liquid fuel rocket, World War II, Wernher von Braun, the V-1 and the V-2, Sputnik, the space race. Then I started breaking down the episodes by year, and I started in 1958, and I generally covered the most important missions in each year from then on.
Yeah.
I covered Explorer, the Soviet Vostok and Voskhod programs, Mercury, and currently, we're in 1965, covering the Gemini missions.
Yeah.
Now, as a bonus, the modern era missions usually have some type of audio available, so I try to splice that in to make the podcast a little more interesting.
Yeah. For me, and if I can just jump in and, sure. and add something to it from a listener's perspective, all of that history has been quite amazing because it puts an awful lot of context around some of the episodes that you're now covering, and we're up into Gemini, aren't we? Mm-hmm. And some of the programs you've got two or three programs for a mission. So for listeners, you get to really understand a mission from start to finish, the human angle, you get the technical side as well. To have got to the point you're up to, we talked about your interests, but how were you inspired to pull the program together like this?
Well, mainly my childhood interest, beginning with Apollo 7, and my continued interest in space exploration, my interest in history and technology, and I wanted to do something to herald the achievements that have gone on and have been forgotten by many, many people, especially the Gemini program we're on is the forgotten program.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that out in front of people. And my real goal to inspire some young person to choose a career in space exploration or in a technical area that they can really contribute to the human capacity or the human needs, and a type of something like physics or math or science or preferably space
exploration. To be that inspiration for some of those youngsters.
Yes,
And for me, and again, I come from a similar era to you, I'm learning something new every single episode. You know, there's a lot of detail in there and it's very involved. And at the moment, you're producing these weekly. How do you go about researching each of these episodes?
I spend a lot of time in researching these episodes. That's where my history and information science background comes into play.
Yeah.
I use basically the standard sources, history books, biographies, encyclopedias, information from NASA, the Internet Archive, and a variety of online sources. And in fact, at my website, spacerockethistory.com, there is a tab there, and you can click on it, and you can see all the sources I've used so far.
Right.
I think I'm up to about 72 sources now.
Wow.
I would say it takes about between 20 and 30 hours to make a podcast.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time.
I have some sympathy with you, but I certainly have never seen the detail that's gone into the work you've created here. And I think that it's so original in its style. I think you really do have almost the definitive rocket history podcast here. Now, I'm up to episode 65. I think there's one or two more.
66 is the last one.
Right, okay. I've still got one in the feed then. And we're Gemini 7. So I think people there can understand how much detail there is. Is the plan to continue right up through Apollo and Skylab and the shuttle and right through to the ISS?
Right now, the plan is to cover at least through Apollo 17.
Right.
Once I reach there, I want to reassess things and see if my listeners still want me to continue, and if they're interested in the Skylab, the shuttle, the ISS, or do they think going past Apollo is anticlimactic? And then the other issue is, if do I have enough time to continue doing it? That's an important thing, because it takes a long time.
Yeah.
I tell you, when I began the podcast, I did not think it would take 66 episodes to get to Gemini. I mean, that's a lot of episodes just to get there.
It is. No, and they're about, you know, some are 30 minutes long, but some are a little bit longer as well. So, you know, just to give people a flavor, you know, they're anything from half an hour up to 45 minutes. But it gives the listener a feel for how long they are and how much work you've put into it. In terms of coming through the NASA programs, certainly the earlier developments in rocket history, you covered particularly the Soviet ones as well. Are there any other rockets that will come into the age group up to Apollo from any other nations?
What I do is, by year, I get the most important events. I think France has an event coming up soon.
Yeah.
And I covered one one from the UK, I believe. There was a launch, a satellite built in the UK that was launched.
Yep, you did. Yeah, you did.
And so basically it's I try not to just be on one nation. I try to spread it out and find whoever's done what. But mostly, most of the things that have gone on were between the Soviets and the U.S.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I'm not meaning to leave anybody out. If I find something to cover, then I'll do that.
Well, let's get into the real devil in the detail then. What's your favorite rocket or mission?
Well, that is a tough one there. Of course, I have a U.S. bias.
Yeah.
So I think about the early missions with Alan Shepard, John Glenn, even Alexei Leonov's spacewalk.
Yeah.
And, of course, the first U.S. spacewalk. And then there are the missions I haven't covered yet. Apollo 11, where Kennedy reached his goal of landing a man on the moon and returned him safely to Earth. Then there's Apollo 13, the successful failure. It was NASA's finest hour, I think, and because of all the adversity they overcame to return the astronauts back to the Earth. But if I had to pick one favorite episode, I'm going to have to take Apollo 11, because Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon, that was kind of the high point of human technological achievement, I think, in my opinion anyway. Events after that seem somewhat anticlimactic, I guess. And and until we get to Mars, I think that's the way it's going to be. I think Mars is the next big step, and gosh, I hope that would be soon.
Yeah, and Mike, what do you feel about, I suppose, the current state of space exploration? There's been a raft of planetary missions, some quite amazing missions. How do you feel about what's going on in terms of relationships around the world and some of the technical developments?
Well, as far as relationships around the world, I think it's a little bit embarrassing for the U.S. not to have a capability of putting a man in space, sending one up to the ISS, depending upon the Russians and Putin to do that is not a good position. It would be so great to have one a Saturn 1B in our back pocket right now that we could use to send up to the space station. I would love that. But go ahead.
I was going to say, it's funny that some of the technology that's still being launched is not that dissimilar, is it?
The Russian? No, it's not. It's Soyuz, really.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I guess we could have stuck with the Apollo and we would still be able to send men in space. Of course, we would not. I mean, the shuttle was a great program. Don't get me wrong. That was a great program, and it was technologically much more advanced than Apollo. But it is demeaning, really, to the U.S. not to be able to put a man into space from where we've come and how far we've fallen. And I don't blame anybody in particular. It's the government kind of didn't have the money or did not want to spend the money on NASA. That would be a key thing to do that. And that's kind of why we're in the situation we are now.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sad.
Well, certainly the programs in the feed at the moment and the ones to come certainly will catch the ear of any of the listeners who've not listened to your program. I highly recommend it. It's a really enjoyable listen, but it's really informative. Where can we find out about the program online, Mike?
Well, Peter, I'm glad you asked that. My website is called spacerockethistory.com. All one word, no spaces.
Right, okay. And you're on Twitter and Facebook as well?
Yes, you can find the Twitter and the Facebook links on the homepage, or you can search Facebook for Space Rocket History and you'll find it there. And my Twitter handle is @SpaceRocketHist, H-I-S-T. Didn't have enough letters available to finish that out, unfortunately.
Well, Mike, as I said, I think you can take from my comments that I'm a fan. I'm absolutely addicted to the program. Can't wait to see it go up through to Apollo. Thanks very much for producing the program, and thank you very much for coming onto the program with us.
Well, it is a honor to be here, Peter. I appreciate all the kind words. I enjoy your podcast as well, and thank you for doing it, and it's just been a pleasure. Thank you.
Mike, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's up to Gemini 6 and Gemini 7 at the moment. I just listened to the latest episode, and it was just absolutely unbelievable that the two of them spent 14 days in that tiny capsule. And one of the interesting things, and, you know, as I say in the interview, I learn something every show, is the stresses of the G-forces on re-entry, because they've been weightless for 14 days, pretty much sat down all that time. And, of course, the G-forces have an extra force on the body, particularly after the weightlessness. So really interesting stuff. But the Gemini program, Gareth, I know you're interested in this area. I've learned a lot from Mike already, but still a lot to go.
Yeah, and Gemini was incredibly important. You know, we'll think of Mercury and the Mercury 7 and, you know, the space, the actual space race, you know, kicking off, and, you know, Gagarin and the American astronauts. But, you know, then people tend to think about Apollo and the moon landings. That would not have happened without Gemini. Gemini proved lots and lots of technology and techniques and physiology as well, as you've just said about, you know, I think people need to remember there were doctors and medicine people when the space race launched who basically said, you can't send man into space, he's just going to die.
He's going to be done, yeah.
You know, his eyes are going to pop out of his head, or his stomach's going to... Seriously, you know, people genuinely thought, you know, as indeed, there were people who thought that they were going to land on the moon and they would be, you know, attacked by sort of Martians, or, you know, well, not Martians, but you know what I mean, you know, little green men and all that sort of stuff. So Gemini, really, really important. It's also got one of my favorite stories, which I believe I've related on Extended before, which I think might have been Tom Stafford. I would have to go away and double check it, who actually fell asleep sort of with his head out of the door doing a sort of spacewalk on a Gemini. they actually dropped off orbiting the Earth. Which was just absolutely bonkers. But yeah,
well, one of the things that I picked up is, you know, we talk about these guys being test pilots and the need for test pilots at that time. This was no easy stuff. I mean, not that going to the ISS is in any way easy now, but then, as you say, none of this had been done. Everything was new, including things like the wearing of full space suits. And in the recent episodes, Mike explains that basically Capcom wanted them to wear their flight suits all the time. Now, we've all seen pictures of what these flight suits look like, and 14 days in that would have, I think, you know, killed the poor guys. But they worked out on the 6A and 7 flights that you didn't need them all the time. And these little issues are what we see today in, you know, in practical terms on the ISS and on the space stations before. So, you know, we owe these guys an awful lot.
I think I have to say as well that Gemini, just from its sheer looks, is one of my favourite spacecraft, you know, and it looks like it's a proper... You know, somebody's piloting it. You know, I don't know if it's windows or...
Well, they actually flew it.
Yeah, but, you know, it looks like it's got a kind of a cockpit kind of feel to it. And, you know, one of the interesting things there was going to be the basis for a spy space station in orbit, the manned orbiting laboratory. And the US Air Force was interested in this to go and send up a Gemini B attached to like a small space station for 40-day missions. And the idea would be a couple of guys there taking pictures of the Soviet Union and bringing the film back.
No, amazing stuff. Actually, talking of what they looked like, there's a great picture on Mike's website on spacerockethistory.com of the two Gemini capsules sitting on the deck of the... USS Wasp, I think, because of course they splashed down very close together, because these were the first two ships to rendezvous in space. So if you want to see what they look like, go to his webpage and you can see them there. He also mentioned the model making at the beginning of that interview. Do either of you guys remember the Apollo 5 Airfix model and the size of the box? I mean, I never got it. It was always too expensive. We can never afford it. But that was the biggest one.
I do remember it. And I remember on...
That was, yeah.
James May on his program where he ended up flying in the U2. He had the Airfix kit at the start of that. I remember because he was just, you know, to demonstrate the technology and how it all worked. But yeah, that was an incredible model, wasn't it? I bet I wonder if you could buy one of those now. You find it on eBay or something like that. Probably worth a fortune.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
But
probably.
I've got a bit of catching up to do with Mike, haven't I, Peter?
Yeah. You have. 67 episodes, I think. I got to say, though, I genuinely really, really enjoyed listening to them and well worth a listen. So do dig in there, have a listen to what Mike's doing. He's doing a great job. And as he said there, you know, the effort that goes into these programs, 30 hours to produce one 30-minute to 45-minute program is just a dedication that needs to be applauded.
Mike, hopefully you'll be listening to this. Thank you for your time, and hopefully I'll be at a legion of new fans for the Space Rocket History podcast. Thanks, Mike.
And T-minus 1 minute, the Soyuz now on internal power, and we have auto-sequence start. So again, watch out for those two umbilical towers, which will separate from the booster. That first umbilical separating, indicating we're about 35 seconds away from launch. Launch command has been issued. That second umbilical we're tracking. The booster is beginning to fire. We have preliminary booster ignition. And liftoff. Liftoff of Reid Wiseman, Max Sarayev, and Alexander Gerst. International crew on their way to the International Space Station. Right now getting good first stage performance. The Soyuz delivering 930,000 pounds of thrust.
Okay, so next up, we've got another fantastic segment for you, but we're right back home home for us anyway, here in the UK. David Ashford is a designer. He's CEO of Bristol Space Plane. Bristol, there's a name for a aviation company, eh, with a bit of history behind it. And Peter, you spoke to him about the UK aerospace sector and Bristol's Ascender space plane.
David, welcome to Extended.
Hi.
David, before we get to talk about some of the really exciting projects that you've got and are developing, can you tell us a little bit about your aerospace background?
Yeah, I did aero engineering at Imperial College, and then a bit of postgrad in America, a research assistant. And then my first job, Hawker Siddeley Aviation, Advanced Projects Group. This was in the early 1960s, working on their space plane project. And we were going to revolutionize space flight. The group think at the time was that the space age was only a few years old, using converted ballistic missiles to launch satellites.
Yeah.
This was obviously never going to be economical. So we wanted to get the thing back, put wings, tail, landing gear, cockpit on.
Yeah.
Fly it back. And so you've got an aeroplane instead of a missile.
Yeah.
And most big aircraft companies at the time had the, generally speaking, the same idea. And there was a consensus. These are the biggest companies. There were eight big companies in Europe and about the same in America, the big names. And we all thought it was the obvious thing to do. And just about feasible. And the crazy thing is it never happened. Initially, the pressures of the Cold War, the space race to the moon, meant that the eye was taken off the ball of getting costs down.
Yeah.
These design teams, aircraft design teams mostly, with a little bit of input from missile people and re-entry people, were allowed to disband. And this large body of knowledge has been largely forgotten.
Yeah,
were overlooked, except by me. My unique selling point is I'm one of the very few who was young enough at the time, because it was my first job, and I was pretty young, to have a job at all in the aircraft industry. I'm one of the very few who took part in these 1960s studies, went to the conferences, read the papers, wrote a paper of my own, who's still active in the field.
Right, okay. Okay, and not only have you had a long-standing career in aerospace, but you've written books as well.
Yeah, I've written three books. The first one was the first series book on space tourism called Your Spaceflight Manual.
Yeah.
That came out in 1990. Second book, Spaceflight Revolution, Imperial College Press, 2002, I think it was. My latest book came out last year.
Right, and what's that one?
It's called Space Exploration, and it's published by Hodder in their All That Matters series.
Yeah.
And that explains... It looks innocuous. It just looks like a nice little book on space exploration. But actually, it preaches revolution. It preaches a very dramatic transformation of space flight very soon.
Right.
Using 1960s ideas, but up-to-date technology. It would have been a difficult development in the 60s.
Yeah.
But it would now be straightforward.
Right, okay.
And the amazing thing is, the big space agencies, the big space contractors don't want to know.
Hmm.
The obstacle is groupthink mindset.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call it.
Is that because it's too expensive or too risky or what is it? Because, you know, we've gone through that whole Apollo and space shuttle revolution. An interest in aerospace seems to have waned a little bit. But the Bransons of this world are bringing a bit of enthusiasm and dynamism to the sector. Why wouldn't anyone want to do it?
Well, that is a very difficult question to answer. It's corporate groupthink.
Yeah.
Space policy is dominated by big, monopolistic government agencies.
Yeah.
And they're not known for being the first to promote radical new ideas.
Mm.
That's one reason. The other reason is because these 1960s space planes weren't developed when they could have been and should have been,
there's
a cultural chasm between the aviation industries and the space industries. There's very few aero engineers understand launch vehicles and vice versa.
Right, okay.
And the third reason is you're talking about three revolutions all happening at once, changing the technology, switching from a missile type approach to an aviation type approach, a revolution in the government involvement from leadership to support and regulation, which it does, as with the aviation industry.
Yeah.
And the third revolution is markets, from a few niche, very specialised products, space science paid for by the government, and the only really big commercial use of space is communications. Switching from that to a market dominated by tourism.
Yeah.
If you look at the future, once you've got space planes offering a reliable airline service to orbit, what's going to be the biggest, by far the biggest use? And it's people going up to space for a few days in a space hotel. Yeah.
Now, you've been developing this concept for some time, and recently there was a raft of publications, the Financial Times, Wired.com, lots of articles about the work that you've done. Tell us a little bit about, and I'm looking at a great picture on your wall, the Ascender project.
Well, we've got a step-by-step development sequence. Four space planes, each one intended to get the credibility and the funding for the next one. The first thing, we've called it Microsonic. It's a single-seat space plane the size of a smallish home-built aeroplane.
Okay.
With two little jet engines and a little rocket engine, and it's capable of very brief flights up and down to space.
Yeah.
The object of that is just to dent the mindset, to get people taking what we're saying seriously. We've got a mouth-watering business case.
Yeah.
We've got a raft of books, technical papers, and we've proved beyond any reasonable doubt that what we're saying is worth taking seriously.
Yeah.
That on a very modest budget, low cost, low risk, you can transform space flight.
Okay.
Get from a space paradigm and a missile paradigm to an aviation one.
Yeah.
We've proved that it ought to be taken seriously, and it is not being taken seriously.
Mm.
So that's the object of Microsonic. Once you've got something flying, people are going to say, what's going on?
Yeah.
Right, the next vehicle is called Ascender.
Yeah.
And it's like Microsonic, but two seats, and bigger, obviously. And that's our first vehicle that will earn money.
Right.
Two seats, suborbital. It's like what Richard Branson's doing, but far less ambitious.
Yeah.
He uses existing technology, whereas he uses new technology.
He also, the difference is that he's looking to launch
his space vehicle from another vehicle at height, whereas your plan is to take that aircraft from the ground, traditionally launch it from the runway all the way up and all the way down, fully reusable, one aircraft.
That's absolutely true. But I wouldn't say that by itself is desperately significant. The two big differences are, one, the basic difference, his project is far more ambitious. Mm. It's carrying six passengers who are free to float around in zero G.
Yeah.
We're carrying one passenger who stays strapped in.
Right, okay.
We don't use any new technology. Our design is very similar to that of the Saunders Roe 53 rocket fighter, but flew in 1957.
Yeah.
Which is an indication of how crazy the situation is.
Yeah.
When it got cancelled as a fighter, Saunders Roe proposed converting the two prototypes for space research.
Yeah.
Delete the jet. It had jet and rocket engines, so they were going to delete the jet engine to make room for more rocket fuel.
Right.
Air launch it from a V-bomber, a Valiant.
Yeah.
And it would have gone up. It would have had suborbital capability.
Right, okay.
Anyway, that's a sender. It's like what Branson's doing, but far less ambitious.
Yeah, but this isn't just pie in the sky. You've had the engines tested, you've done modelling of the aircraft. You're some way along the route.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've spent, all in all, depends how you define it, but we've spent getting on for 300K.
Yeah.
We've started bench testing the rocket engine,
yeah.
And we've built a 9-foot-long radio control model.
Right.
Oh no, we're quite sure. We've had study contracts from four government agencies, so we're off the crazy list.
Yeah, but I mean, to be quite frank, you know, reading a little bit of your biography, you've worked with NASA, you've done lots of aerospace work before. This isn't just somebody drawing pictures and coming up with this stuff, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, when it became obvious that these space planes weren't going to get built, various other new projects weren't going to get built, they closed down the Hawke City Advanced Projects Group.
Yeah.
Just before they closed it down, I got a job with Douglas in Long Beach, California.
Yeah.
Aerodynamicist on the DC-8, project engineer on the DC-10.
Mm.
Then my wife and I wanted to come back to England, so got a job at Filton. Mm. First of all in the Concorde pre-design group, then in the Skylark sounding rocket project office.
Okay.
And my last few years on naval weapons, project manager on new weapons and electronic warfare.
Yeah.
But all that time I kept an interest in space planes.
Yeah.
One or two papers, talks a year, Aeronautical Society, British Interplanetary Society, Society of Engineers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And took early retirement when it became available and set up Bristol Space Planes.
Yeah. And here we are in your office, delightful views, pictures of your ascender on the wall. Where next? What happens next?
Well, let me just finish our development sequence. So the second vehicle is ascender. The third one is the one that matters. That's Space Cab, because it'll go to orbit. Right. It launches a small satellite, 750 kilos into low orbit.
Right, okay.
Or six astronauts to a space station. And that is designed to be the first successful, fully orbital space plane. You've got to go 8 times faster for orbital than for suborbital. So you need a bigger vehicle for a given payload, and a bit more, 10 times more expensive to develop in round numbers. But that is that vehicle that's going to trigger the revolution. It's like, if you look at the history of aeronautics, before 1783, you couldn't fly at all, unless you were mad and you strapped wings to your arms and threw yourself off a cathedral tower or something. 1783, Montgolfier brothers in France developed the hot air balloon. For the next 100 years, the only way you could fly was in a balloon. Then but you can't have an airline service with balloons.
Yeah.
They won't go into wind. And along come the Wright brothers in 1903 and invent the aeroplane. You've only got to look at it and imagine an airline service, meaning a bit bigger and faster, because they'll go into wind. That led to an explosive growth in aeronautics, a revolution in aeronautics. Well, the first space plane that will go to orbit, fully reusable, capable of serving large new markets, especially space tourism, which means that safety is the dominant design driver. The first vehicle that will do that will trigger the revolution.
Yeah.
The but it doesn't need new technology. Our spacecraft is based, I've taken the best features from the 1960s designs, chucked in one or two of my own, stirred the pot. That's what it is. No new technology. We had a feasibility study contract from the European Space Agency 20 years ago to do a phase A study, which showed you did not need new technology. Development cost less than that of a new expendable vehicle. Quite radical conclusions.
Yeah.
The European Space Agency didn't do anything with it at all, ignored it, told me I couldn't have any more money. My MP got interested. He got the then Minister, Ian Taylor, interested enough to ask the then British National Space Centre to do an independent review. They got in experts from ESTEC, from ESA, and from Farnborough.
Yeah.
And broadly speaking, they endorsed what we were saying.
Right, okay.
So we've got that level of endorsement 20 years ago, and nothing's happened about it.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
Anyway, the final vehicle on the sequence is called Space Cab, which is like Space Bus, sorry, which is like Space Cab, but bigger, 50 seats.
Yeah.
And when that's in service in reasonably large numbers, you've got, and the technology has matured.
Yeah.
A few days in a space hotel will cost the average punter about 1 year's pay. At the moment, if you want to go to the International Space Station, cost you give or take 1,000 years' pay.
Yeah.
So that's the revolution, and that could happen in 15 years.
Yeah.
So that's our development sequence.
Right, okay.
We're trying to promote. Okay.
So with the UK Space Agency now on the map, and with fantastic plans for the aerospace sector in the UK for growth, and we've seen the papers published a few weeks ago about the spaceport, why aren't people embracing what you're doing here, David? How do we get this going now?
Well, people are just beginning
to
embrace it. We had a study contract from the UK Space Agency. And our final report was called The Business Case for a UK space plane based on heritage technology.
Yeah.
And we finished that a year ago.
Right.
And that showed a mouth-watering business case for the UK. The UK can take the lead in space on a shoestring budget. And the UK Space Agency is still thinking about it. But at least for many years...
Yeah.
The BNSC, British National, were totally anti when the UK got out of the launcher business with the cancellation of Blue Streak and Black Arrow in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. It was government policy to have nothing to do with launch vehicles. So you go, you were swimming upstream in a river full of alligators.
Yeah.
The attitude of the government agencies was actually hostile. Well, not hostile, but negative.
Yeah, sure.
Now it's positive. They're open-minded. And nobody's actually said so, but I'm pretty sure that if we can get private... But government policy, which I fully support, is not to put big money into projects that don't have private backing.
Yeah, understand.
That's to prevent another Concorde.
Yeah.
Technically brilliant, but financially disastrous.
Yeah, sure.
You can get a seed study contracts. There's various mechanisms for getting 10-20k to just do a first look at something.
Yeah,
but that's government policy. So we need private investment.
Yeah,
I'm pretty convinced. There's no commitment, but we'll get it matched by the government.
Right, okay.
And that's what we're looking for.
So David, where do things go from here?
Well, we've got two lines of approach. One is to find an industrial partner. And the other is a social media campaign to get enough followers to then look for commercial sponsorship.
Right, okay.
Industrial partners, we've spoken to all the likely people over the years, and they've all said more or less the same thing. Space planes aren't in our strategic plan. And I say, no, it's a disruptive technology, so it wouldn't be, would it?
Yeah.
And the first one of you guys that put it in your strategic plan hits the jackpot, because there's some very good reasons why commercially why you should be first to market or very early to market.
Yeah.
And there's a long pause, and they say, well, you're probably right, but you may be right, but there's a lot of corporate bureaucracy between you and us getting you and any money coming from that.
Yeah.
That attitude is just beginning to change.
Yeah.
And the other thing we're trying is we're just launching a social media campaign.
Right.
And getting, if we can get enough followers,
yeah,
just people following,
yeah,
I don't know anything about social media, so we've got to work out how to do it. If we can get enough people interested, then we can go to companies, branded companies, that,
yeah,
their livelihood depends on brand recognition. And say, invest in our space plane and you'll have, guarantee you, number one headlines for 10 years.
Yeah. So where can we find out more about Bristol Space Planes online?
We've got a website.
Okay.
I'd recommend the next thing for people that are interested is to read the book, Space Exploration, published by Hodder.
What else have you got up your sleeve? You're very creative. I can see that from all the products. What's next on the drawing board?
Well, when I've got the space project in good hands, and it's quite clearly going to happen, I will switch to other things.
Yeah.
But I'll keep those to myself for now.
David, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, my pleasure.
Tim, interesting approach to using existing and past technology to deliver a modern space plane.
It is. I mean, you know, it's got. It's definitely got. You know, it's interesting how you're saying that. You know, in the 60s, everyone thought, you know, the space plane was the way to go. You know, not just in the US, but you know, you'd got people working on it in the UK and Europe as well. You know, space plane would be the way. So he's really trying to sort of, you know, continue this on. And indeed, you know, we've gone a little bit sort of full circle anyway with Virgin Galactic, you know, Spaceship Two. You know, kind of a souped-up X-15, if you like.
And he calls his product disruptive technology, I think it was the term he used, basically because it's not in anyone's strategic plan. I think the thing I like about David and the team at Bristol Space Planes is it's exciting, you know, that there's people like him with the skill, ingenuity, and more importantly, the perseverance to do something like this.
Definitely, I think you know. I think he's been facing an uphill battle in you know, sort of putting his views across. But I mean, you know, it's interesting. Like we were talking about earlier in this episode, you know, people are now searching around and going, oh, hang on, you know, the UK has got a thriving space sector. We, you know, whatever programs has it got? Okay, well, you've got this, you've got that. So. You know, the more competition and the more ideas there are that are fed into this, you know, not all of them are going to succeed, not all of them are getting anywhere, but that at least gives people choices and you know, potential investors who look at this and go, right, okay, actually, we want to get part of this.
Yeah.
Who do we back? Well, you know, that's all got to be good. The more people there involved in the sector, the better.
Oh, we see the hatch moving now. They're opening it. It's going inside towards the bill. The first face we see is a smiling face. That's Alex going up. Pausing for a moment. Posing for the picture. And now he's in.
Alexander Gerst now on the International Space Station. He must be so relieved to get out of that Soyuz.
He looks extremely happy, not quite used to weightlessness.
Okay guys, next up we know this is now rapidly becoming one of your favourite segments of the show, so even though this isn't space related, we daren't leave it out because it's always a talking point now. I give you Tim Robinson and his X-10.
Okay, here we are, episode 27's X-10, our top 10. This episode of Extended, our top 10 airline call signs. What makes a good call sign? Combination of cool, nostalgia, or perhaps a play on words with the airline's name. Let's count down the top 10. At number 10, Cedar Jet, Middle East Airlines. Cedar is the national tree of Lebanon. So is it natural that the flag carrier MEA, which also has a tree on its tail fin, should use this call sign. Number 9, Springbok, South African Airways. Using a national animal as a flag carrier's call sign also works. Hence, Springbok for South African Airways. Also the name of the rugby team too. So again, it links the call sign strongly with the country. Number 8, Penguin, British Antarctic Survey. Not an airline as such, but still a pretty cool call sign. Number 7, Giant, Atlas Air. Some of the best call signs are obviously a play on words or an alternate way of referring to the carrier's name. Freight carrier's Atlas, then, is naturally a giant, holding up the world. Number 6, Dynasty, China Airlines. Nope, they're not bigger 1980s soap fans over there, but Dynasty is the call sign of Taiwanese airline, China Airlines. Number 5, Cactus, US Airways. When Sully Sullenberger put Cactus Flight 1549 on the Hudson River in 2009, he instantly gave this old America West call sign an even more heroic status. Number 4, Nitro, TNT Airways. You would think that choosing a call sign after a bomb ingredient would be the tempting fate, but nitroglycerine, for cargo carrying TNT is certainly explosive. They also use a small sober quality. Number 3, Shamrock, Aer Lingus. There's obviously a plant botany call sign link going on here, and for Irish flag carrier, it has to be the Lucky Shamrock. Number 2, Clipper, Pan American Airways. No longer in use, but Clipper dates from Pan Am's seaplane days. Even in the height of the jet age, it was effortlessly cool. And number 1, it has to be Speedbird, British Airways. Wherever you are, you hear a clipped British voice in the plane saying Speedbird 345, and you feel reassured, nostalgic, and if you're a Brit, quietly proud. The Speedbird, of course, refers to the original BOAC style-edged bird logo. Perhaps the most Speedbird of all was Concorde. Even now, the association remains. So, guys, what's your favourite call sign, civil or military? The B-22s that were over in the UK had Death as a call sign, which is...
Yeah, that was fairly
memorable.
And the B-52s
what do people at home think? Doom, yeah.
Yeah. I also noticed, Tim, that British Airways had a few call signs, one of which was Gherkin.
Gherkin?
Yes. And I believe Gherkin is used for the all-business flight that flies from London City Airport to New York, and I could be wrong, and if I am, please do write in and tell me so, but I think it comes from the landmark in London, which was the landmark building called the Gherkin. So interesting, never knew that. But I do like Speedbird, and I also like the TNT one, Nitro. That's pretty cool.
Have you got a famous, a favourite call sign?
No? I quite like, it's always made me chuckle, 29 Reserve Squadron RAF Coningsby the Typhoon OCU uses Rockstar. Which is quite cool.
Yeah, that's good.
I think I quite like Rockstar.
Jedi, who's Jedi?
Jedi was 9 Squadron?
Nice.
Possibly. Gold Stars is good. There are some real crackers out there. Some good ones. But Death and Doom were quite good.
Do let us know what your favourite call signs are, military or civil, and we'll see if we agree with you.
Ghost Rider was pretty cool, wasn't it? Fantastic. Well done, Tim. Good stuff. But
yeah, great segment. Well done.
Loving it. Okay, we haven't left space completely, and we have got another brilliant segment to play you shortly, but I think we're going to go on to a bit of feedback now.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
we're going to start off with a bit of Twitter action. And guys, have you read the piece that Get Into Flying put out? There's a consultation going on with the CAA about this sort of GA policy, which is very, very interesting.
Very exciting, yeah. I mean, yeah. That's... wow. The potential passengers for warbirds, CAA loosening the rules a little bit, that would be... you know, that would be very, and, you know, as a way of raising, you know, kind of, revenue to keep some of these old aircraft flying and be able to, for, not passengers, I suppose, but to be able to take people up. Yeah, that's a good move. Has to be.
Yeah, I mean, we hear a lot about regulation creeping in other parts of the world. And of course, you know, with EASA here, a decade or so ago, we saw all the licenses change, and I was one of those casualties. I was partway through my PPL fly-in, up went the gates, raised the bar, and I dropped out. And it's really good to see the CAA here taking a stance that says, you know, how can we grow this sector? How can we make it easier for people to be a part on it, and how can it become a feeder for other parts of the aerospace sector? So again, coming back to the points we talked about earlier, this is another one of those building blocks that, if it comes through, will help the UK to be competitive and grow the aerospace sector. There's a fantastic report written by our good friend Jonathan Duke on the Get Into Flying website all about this. So if you're interested, do get involved in the consultation, get hold of whatever group you're a part of, because this is your chance to change the future of general aviation in the UK.
Very, very well put. Very well put. And yeah, I totally would go with that. You know, you can't, unless you get involved now, then you can't necessarily very well complain when nothing happens. So
go and
get your say. We got a message from ATC Ben, which I think was on Twitter, which was, I think, relating to the X10 defunct airlines by the looks of it. And Tim, what have Ansett, Kendall, Australian Impulse and Brinda Bella all got in common?
They all went bust.
as the feedback said, there's a bit of a additional Australian flavour for us.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Not that all Australian airlines go bust, but Qantas aren't doing too well, are they?
No. And David Vanderhoof sent a message in saying Air America or the Flying Tigers, which was nice as well. So,
yes.
Flying Tigers almost did make it into the list, yeah.
If it had been an X-11, then they may have been there. G. McCulker posted the story about the commercial spaceport that we've kind of already made a small reference to. And as Glenn Towler said on our Facebook, sounds like a brilliant idea. The UK needs to get into space, but why let Virgin do it all?
Well, they're not, I think, as we're starting to see. I think, again, you know, this is the impression of the British aerospace sector, because, of course, you know, Richard Branson and Virgin are doing what they're doing in the US. But slowly but surely, you know, we see people like David, who we talked to earlier, starting to develop a lot more coming out of the UK. So we're very proud of Virgin and Richard Branson, but he's followed by a great stable of other opportunities coming.
Absolutely, and there's some good discussion on there from Joseph Chung, who's another great fan of the show as well. Just raising some of the sort of public sector, you know, legislative issues, if you like. It's funny when you guys were chatting earlier, I was sitting here wondering, you know, when we're all old and decrepit, or older and more decrepit, are we going to be recording an episode of Extended and talking about where's the third runway for the spaceport going to go?
It'll still be where's the third runway for Heathrow.
Yeah, we'll still be talking about that, yeah, when we're drawing our pensions. But there we go.
Brilliant. Now, we have got a space flavour with this. This is Pod's challenge. Amy has very, very kindly sent this challenge in for the three of us.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim, and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. This episode, I have a space-related pause challenge for everybody, and I would like to know, would you like to be on a one-way trip to Mars, and if so, why? Also, if not, why? Can't wait to hear the responses, and I'll speak to you all in the next episode. Bye!
Well, what can you say?
Does she want to get rid of us?
Yeah. Do you know what? Mike said something earlier. He said Apollo's mission was to land someone on the moon and safely return them back to Earth. And on the basis that if they can't do that to Mars, I don't really want to go. I'm unfortunately one of those people that wouldn't really want to make the one-way trip. I've got too much here to still enjoy. But, you know, there is a big long list of people who are signing up to the one-way trip to Mars. So, you know, it's whatever takes your fancy. But there's some really interesting articles on Facebook that, interestingly enough, Gene McCulker has been posting over the last week on this very topic. So if you're interested in it, go look him up. He's got some very interesting views on the technology and the strategy of getting people to Mars. But for me, no.
Tim, do you want a chance to make history?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you're not sort of saying, are you going to be the first there? Or are you going to be the second batch? Or is there going to be a thriving community? It's going to be pioneer spirit, isn't it? Whether you're first, second batch, third batch,
could be your generation's Buzz Aldrin.
I don't know.
Yeah, but he came back.
I would rule myself out, and I rule myself out because I think you still need people there with the right stuff and a good, very good engineering sort of polymaths who are, you know, the kind of people who are still like, you know, a little bit like Buzz Aldrin, who are able to quickly pick stuff up and right, okay, you know, something's broken down, I need to do this, you know, the real high-flying types before you get on to the aviation journalists like me who'll be go, oh, what's happened? And you know, next year, you know, the colony's dead. I think for that, you're so far away from help. You need the self-reliant, and you need the best of the best to go. I don't think that's me.
So are you the best of the best, Gareth?
Well, I've given this some real thought. Amy, you're a big fan of Extended. I know that you read Global Aviation Resource and stuff as well. I'm too busy, quite frankly, to be honest, because what with the podcast and the website and the day job and the air show reviews and stuff like that, you know, the dogs won't walk themselves. Let's face it. I've just got too much on, to be honest with you. And it is quite a long trip. Well, actually, it's, you don't come back, do you? So it's, you're just gone. I think it's an absolutely fascinating thing to think about. I agree with Tim. I think you've got to be a special kind of person to be, you know, the one or part of the group. It's not for me, though, I don't think. Not for me.
No.
Despite the fact that we, you know, hands up if you'd like to be an astronaut, the old, you know, the hand goes up. But, yeah, going and coming back would be ideal.
Yeah. And one of the things that Gene talks about in the articles I mentioned is the fact that there's some interesting analysis on whether introverts or extroverts are the right people to travel out there. And interestingly enough, the science is suggesting that it's introverts that would be better because, well, putting it quite simply, extroverts would drive you bonkers and cause a lot of crew disruption. So there's some interesting dynamics, but do you know what? It needs a proper strategy. When NASA went to the moon, they had a 10-year strategy and a plan to get there. And we've talked about Gemini and all those other things. I just don't think we have that in humanity at the moment to set an objective like that to deliver it because it all boils down to money. And
I don't think that. I think it's definitely doable with the right plan, the right cooperation, and the You know, I talked to the NASA's chief scientist recently, and she had a couple of challenges, you know, the radiation and the re-entry, you know, technical challenges. But my question would be on the human factors side.
Hmm.
For example, you've got that Mars One plan where they're going to turn it into a reality TV show, and all right, they're going to psychologically screen people and the rest of it, but you know, 5 minutes with watching Big Brother in the UK or Celebrity Big Brother, and you think, are these the kind of people you really want to be trapped on Mars with? Are they going to be the ones that make the good decision, or is somebody kind of going to go off and you know, leave the airlock open and, you know, those sort of things? You know, you do want somebody to sit down quite sort of sober and say, as NASA did, we're going to pick Neil Armstrong to be the first man on the moon. Why? Because he's an engineer through and through. He's completely unruffled, you know, and he's that kind of character that he's not going to kind of, you know, A, panic, and B, come back and, you know, kind of go bananas afterwards. You know, he can take it all in his stride, and that's what happened, you know. You know, afterwards, well, you know, he doesn't do interviews, he doesn't talk about it. Well, you know, he's an engineer. He's an engineer and test pilot.
Yeah. But that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are we back to needing test pilots for missions like this?
I don't think, but, you know, maybe look at the source scientific, you know, Dr. Alan Stoffen from NASA was saying, you know, it's not about putting an astronaut on Mars, it's about putting a scientist on Mars.
Interesting. Great challenge, though, Amy. Well done,
Amy. And, okay, we're going to move on to another segment now, and this is absolutely fascinating. Peter, we've been working quite hard in the last few weeks because this is you again. This is with Jasmine Evans, who's a blogger. She's a student of astrophysics, and she is talking about the STEMETs, which is a fascinating organization which is all about inspiring girls to go into the STEM subjects. We've already heard mention of them tonight, then we're going to hear a bit more now. It's science, technology, engineering and mathematics. Let's have a listen to Jasmine.
Welcome to Extended.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jasmine, I came across your blog and I noticed that you attended the Last Man in the Moon event. Tell us a little bit about it. What was it like?
Well, it was at the Sheffield Documentary Festival.
Yeah.
And the film itself had actually premiered at Space Fest, which is an event in Pasadena in May. And all of the Apollo astronauts were over there. And then they brought it to the UK.
Yeah.
And it was first at the Science Museum and then it went over to Sheffield. And Gene himself was actually there.
Wow.
Gene Cernan. It was fantastic.
I've just bought his book, actually, which I'm taking on holiday. I'm very excited. I've got it all closed up and ready to read. He sounds like a really intriguing character.
He really is. Listening to him in the Q&A afterwards was really inspiring.
Yeah.
He's got some wonderful things to say about getting young people interested in space and exploration, and he's a brilliant ambassador for it as well.
Now, you're a student, aren't you? What are you studying?
I study physics with astrophysics.
Wow. Wow, that's impressive. Why did you choose those subjects, Jasmine?
I've always really loved science, and I like problem solving and even the engineering side of things, like actually going and doing stuff and finding out for myself. And I thought, what better way to do it than physics?
Yeah. Okay, that's quite a complex set of subjects, Jasmine. Astrophysics, what's that all about?
It's about basically learning about the universe.
Yeah.
And I like to think it's about exploring as much as it is learning about it.
Yeah.
The technology involved is quite incredible.
It really is amazing. And in the material that you're studying, what sort of exposure do you get to that technology?
Well, we're in the labs quite a lot. We do lab sessions every week, and that's learning kind of all the applications of physics. And these obviously go into the research methods as well.
So
there's a lot of internship opportunities that are offered to undergraduates to actually go and experience it for yourself and work on these new technologies.
Yeah.
And that's a great opportunity.
And you're scheduled to attend the Student STEMET event. Have I pronounced that right?
It's Student Food STEMET, yeah.
Okay, what's that about?
STEMET is an organisation that inspires girls to get into the STEM subjects, so science, technology, engineering and maths.
Yeah.
And they run lots of projects and workshops. They get girls hacking and coding and making their own apps. And their new scheme is called Student to STEMET, and it's sponsored by Deutsche Bank. And the launch event is next Tuesday, the 24th of June.
Right, okay. So that might be just about the time we publish. But what are the things that you expect to be involved in on the day?
Well, we go and meet six women who all work in STEM industries.
Yeah.
And we get to chat to them and see what they do. And then the most suitable one for us becomes our mentor.
Right, okay.
And after that, we get monthly meetings with our mentor and a chance to find out more about careers in the industry that maybe hadn't thought of before.
Okay.
And then there's monthly webinars as well.
Right, okay. Now, you name Valentin Tereshkova, Helen Sharman and Dr. Carolyn Porco as real role models for you.
Yeah.
From what I can see, you're a real ambassador yourself for STEM in aerospace. How do you see the role of women developing in the sector?
Well, I think there's definitely a real opportunity for women to get involved in the industry. It's just about breaking the stereotype. I mean, women are vastly underrepresented in areas like this. I think if you get girls to see that you can enjoy science and engineering, then there's no reason not to give it a go.
You do make the statement that you don't believe in diversity for diversity's sake.
No, I mean, it's not about just getting women into science for the sake of it. You have to get them passionate about what they're doing, get them interested and say, yeah, this is a valid area for you to be interested in and get involved in.
Yeah. And what is it that makes you so passionate about aerospace then?
I just love finding things out. I mean, the furthest place that we've been is to the moon. We've got so much further to go, so much more to find out. And the technology and everything that we need to research to get there is really in its prime now.
Yeah.
And it's just such a fascinating area to be around.
And the British aerospace sector is booming at the moment and set to boom further. Where would you like to be in, say, 5 to 10 years?
Oh, good question. I definitely like to be working in the aerospace industry.
Yeah.
Even in something like robotics and rovers and things like that. To get involved in that side would be fantastic. But I think the British aerospace industry especially will be a leader in 5 to 10 years' time, definitely.
Well, we think so too, and hopefully you're going to be one of those leaders too. Can you tell us a little bit about where we can find out about you online, Jasmine?
My blog is called Rockets and Robots, so that's rocketsandrobotsblog.blogspot.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter at @astro_jazz.
Jasmine, thanks so much for joining us today. It was done at short notice. Appreciate your patience, but I really think it's a powerful story to tell.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Pete, that's absolutely fantastic, wasn't it? Brilliant.
Yeah, I came across Jasmine's blog and I thought, what a refreshing approach to aerospace. Let's try and get her to come and talk to us and tell us a little bit about herself. And to be fair to her, it was very short notice. It was only in the last day or two. She very kindly cleared her diary to do that interview. And how lucky is she to have met Gene Cernan?
Yes.
How lucky. You know, so, no, a wonderful lady, wishing her every success in her career. And as I think I said there, you know, not only an ambassador, but I think one of those leaders for the future. And we talked about lots and lots of projects in this show. It's people like Jasmine we're going to need to deliver those sorts of things.
Definitely, yeah.
Couldn't have put it better myself, Peter. Very, very well said. And thanks, Jasmine. Thank you to everybody who's featured on this space special. We really, really do appreciate it. So, promoting aerospace, our regular little slot to talk about a few things that have maybe caught our eye. Peter, can we kick off with you?
Yeah, I got a couple of things just to put out there. I mentioned earlier the magazine that's well worth a read, but our very good friends from Rouse Space contacted us, and Sarah Smart got in contact with me last week on something that she's looking for our listeners to help out with. And this is a report entitled "How Far Would You Go for Space Weather?" Now, space weather studies show how solar activity impacts our activities on Earth. For example, you know, the disruption to services and spacecraft operations through solar flares and things like that. And they're looking to engage with the public to join in an open discussion on space weather. So you can go along to the website, which is talkspaceweather.com. There'll also be some public workshops, and they're looking for views, they're looking for input, and they're looking for people to participate in this study and exercise. So if you're interested in weather, if you're interested in space weather and its impact on us here on Earth, go along to that website and help them out. So thanks very much, Sarah, for that. The other shout I really wanted to give was an episode of Plane Crazy Down Under, which recently came out, and of course we had Grant on the show a few episodes ago, but Grant and Steve have really excelled on a episode that features everything you want to know about the F-35. But what they've done is go through the whole process of how the F-35 is going to be integrated in Australia. And although it is all about Australia, and if you're in Europe or the US, you may think that's not very relevant, but the detail they go into and the integration that the Australians have, particularly in the US, make this a real international issue and one that we all should better understand. So a great piece of work, but more, as an Av geek, a definitely must listen episode. So get down to that. And cool. Finally, I'll put a link in the show notes to this, but just an interesting little article I saw about a space camp. I didn't know these things actually exist, but they do. So I'll put a link to the show in the show notes for you to go and have a look for yourself.
Are you going?
No.
Okay.
You want to go to Mars? You want to go to the space camp?
No.
Where will you go?
I don't know. Maybe when you read the article about the space camp, you'll make your own mind up. In fact, if you're interested in it, let us know. Let us know what you think about space camp. I think I'd prefer to go to Space Fest. Gene and Jasmine talked about earlier, and in fact there is a UK Space Fest imminent, but unfortunately I'm going to be away, so won't be able to get to it, but next time definitely.
Tim, anything you would like to give a particular mention to?
There's first off, for World War One aviation buffs, obviously it's the anniversary this year, but if you are in London or anywhere nearby, get yourself along to the RAF Museum, 10th to 13th of July. Sir Peter Jackson is curating a World War I film season at the RAF Museum. Films including, obviously, things like the Blue Max, and a unique short film, called Crossing the Line, that was filmed by Sir Peter himself, and is a World War I short that I don't think has been seen on the big screen in the UK before.
Wow. Were any of your X-10 World War I movies or not?
Don't think they were.
Blue Maximum.
I can't remember whether that was in there or not, but okay, brilliant. That sounds
fantastic. Do you know what? We're gonna have to make a separate page for this on the website, I think, Gareth.
Yeah,
all our,
I think so.
X10, so we can go back and reference them. So we'll start capturing some of that in the future.
Definitely.
How about you, Gareth?
It's getting very much into the thick of air show season for me. So that's kind of, I'm sorry, it's a little bit UK centric, but in a couple of weeks' time, I'll be at RAF Waddington for the International Air Show. Then that's followed immediately after by Royal International Air Tattoo. And yes, all looking forward to seeing F-35 and meeting Squadron Leader Hugh Nichols, the Royal Air Force pilot who's going to be bringing that over and displaying it. That's going to be fantastic. Then it's Farnborough. then I believe there's a chance to catch breath momentarily, and then it's the air day at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton. So busy time coming up, but lots and lots of good stuff coming out of that, lots of people to talk to, lots of things lined up, and hopefully some of that will be you'll get to hear that on Extended as well. So we'll put some links to the shows on. I'm sure most of the guys and girls listening will be aware of them already, but maybe some of our listeners from further afield won't know what we've got coming up this year, and there is some good stuff. Looking forward to it. So
I was interestingly I was at Yeovilton last week, actually, with the historic flight. I popped down to see Katie down there, the display manager. Unfortunately, Katie was off, but I did have a few moments with Commander Gott, Chris Gott. Sorry, Chris, who very briefly took me into the hangar to show me the two swordfish that are nicely coming together. And one thing I learned is that there are only two, I think they're Pegasus engines, aren't they, that power the swordfish. There's only two airworthy ones in the world. And of course, they're both allocated to those aircraft. Now, I know because they're the last two, they are having some challenges with those. So fingers crossed, wish them all the very best, and hopefully see two string bags at an air show this year.
Yeah, that's got to be the aim. And they've had a really, really tough few years, the historic flight, not through any fault of their own, but hopefully they'll start to come out the other side of that, and we'll see lots of those lovely old naval aircraft up and about. A couple of Sea Furies would be nice as well, but there we go. That's Promoting Aerospace. Thank you very much, chaps. And I think, crikey, we've done it again. We've pretty much got to the end without anything going too disastrously wrong.
Don't jinx us! Yeah,
he says. I've still got a few bits to read through, so it could still go wrong. We hope you've enjoyed this third space special, extended space special. We'd like to thank NASA, ESA, and SpaceX for the use of their material in the show. I'd like to thank White Hearts for the music, as ever. Peter Dixon for his wonderful voice. And also Doug Worrell and Basic Six for supporting the podcast, full stop. Amy, huge thanks for the challenge. We look forward to the next one. I think we should start sending a few back to you as well, actually. Get you thinking a little bit. Show notes of the episode, as ever, with all the pictures and links and all the rubbish that we've talked about, will all be on aviation-extended.co.uk. And you can also keep in touch with us on facebook.com/aviationextended, and you can find us on Twitter as Aviation Extended, all one word, and there is no E at the beginning of extended, in case you don't know by now, which you really, really should. Our legal policy and use of our material is all on the website. Please ask us before using anything that you hear, because we do put hours and hours of time into putting it all together. Peter, you sound like you want to say something.
Sorry, Gareth, my sound levels are obviously better than they normally are. I didn't mean that to be quite as presumptuous as it was. I just wanted to say that we now have an Amazon.com link on our website. And thank you very much to Joseph for his patience with us last week in getting that up and working. But please do visit our Amazon site. Go to Amazon through our link. That's all you have to do. You shop as normal, but it does give us a little bit back. The show is expensive to produce. We are trying our best to make it self-sufficient, so anything you can do to help us would be gratefully appreciated. And while I'm on my soapbox, if you do download this through iTunes, please leave us a review and tell us what you like about the program.
Very well said. Thank you, Peter. So, Tim, if somebody wants to talk to Tim Robinson online or look at what you do, where can they find you?
Yep, you can find me through the Aero Society website, which is www.aerosociety.com, or I'm tweeting on Twitter at RESTimR.
You can keep track of all Tim's press jollies. Peter, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me normally anything to do with NASCOT Hornet or xtpmedia.co.uk.
My name's Gareth Stringer. I'm Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you can find everything related to GAR at globalaviationresource.com. This has been Extended Episode 27. I hope you enjoyed it. Peter, Tim, thank you both very much.
Thanks for being here. Yep.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
I'll fly on the A350 in a week.
You had a fly in it.
In the A350, yeah.
Did you miss Twitter that day?
I'll be honest with you, David. I can't get an hour with Tim at Farnborough. So you ain't having my hour or two that I catch him.
No books, no book Rogers.
Yeah, really kicked off by the launch of a recent report called the Space and Hello? Innovation...
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I thought you'd gone quiet.
Peter?
Can you hear me? Hello?
He's got the rigged signal here.
Ah, he's been cut off by the looks of that. That was all going so well.
Talking about yourselves?
Hi.
It's going too well, wasn't it?
Hi. Am I back in? Hello? Hello, hello,
Peter?
Hello? Hello?
Ah!
Hello.
Welcome back.
Right. Yes. Sorry about that, chaps.
That's right.
I'm not quite sure what happened there. But
basically, as I just said to Tim, it was all going too well.
Yes.
I had basically, I had teed you up brilliantly to go straight into the news.
Shall I just pick it up?
Yeah, I don't think I can do it that well again.
I was actually talking to you for some time until you said hello, and I thought, what's he saying hello for?
Tim and I both went at the same time.
Right, okay. Just before that, so yeah, you can
it's all right, I know what you mean. Okay.
Sorry, it was four o'clock start this morning.
Jesus.
Excellent.
I have so much fun doing with you guys. I'm serious. What? I don't know if you can. I don't know if you can tell that in my voice, but gosh darn it, I have fun with you guys. I mean, Peter, I would. Oh, I'm just. Oh, I'm jumping up and down right now. Now, just think about it. This is beautiful.
Wonderful.
Ta da.
Three. Two, oh, sorry. Sorry.
It's all right.
No, okay. But I don't know about either of you two, but do you think Elon Musk is the closest thing we have in the world to Tony Stark?
Gotta be, hasn't it? Gotta be.
It just is, isn't it?
I love his quote of I want to die on Mars, just not on impact. I mean, that is.
I sort of wish I was younger, but I also would have to be a lot more intelligent than I am, so I might as well just stay where I am and watch all the others do it.
Your guess is most definitely as good as mine.
Yeah.
And hello to the NSA, who's just joined listening us. Hello, all.
Well, on that note, and it really is a good read. It's a bit about the technology. It's a bit about astrology and a bit about the two together. So if you like the sort of subjects that we're talking about here, that magazine, which is free, is a great download. So well done, Amjad, for doing that. And maybe on a future episode, we'll get Amjad and some of those other guys to come and talk to us.
Peter, you might want to re-record that because you just said astrology.
And of course, I meant astronomy.
Yeah,
that was good as well, wasn't it?
We'll have Russell Brand, Russell Grant, wanted to come on the show.
Thank you, Tim.
I see a very, very bright future for you, Tim. Actually, this month, your planet's most definitely in alignment.
This is going to take ages to edit. There's so many outtakes. All right, I'll do that again.
It's pretty much how long it takes us to record without screwing up, isn't it?
But, but that's just the recording.
That's 50 hours of outtakes.
We're not space related, are we, technically?
Not space related.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. No. That's not space related.
Just occurred to me. It's going to be a bit too late to put one together at short notice.
Now, we're going to hopefully get to see the F5 very, very soon in the UK.
Practically eating my microphone. It does.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.